You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
As we get ever closer to the presidential elections, and don't you wish they were here already, it's growing increasingly difficult to navigate conversations when they veer into politics, unless, you know, everyone agrees, which is why we have invited Philip Galanis back to our show. He writes the New York Times Social Cues column for the Style section each Sunday, and he's the author of the book called Social Cues. I'm very pleased to welcome you back to our show, Philip.
Thank you, Leonard.
And before we begin, I want to remind listeners that you can call in with your particular concerns at 646-433-9692. Or you can write a comment. What do I say? 646. Somebody wrote 646. I read whatever's put in front of me. It actually is 212.
It's been the secret to your success, right?
Well, it's the Ron Burgundy problem, if you remember that film. 212-433-9692. 212-433-WNYC. Or you can write a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. So we have just a little over a week to go before the election. Are you getting a lot of people writing in with problems about that?
Boy, Leonard, it has been a red plus blue makes purple rain this season. I started the column in 2008 in time for the run-up to the McCain-Obama election and got nothing compared to what I'm seeing now. It is a manner, it runs the gamut from really funny to really heartbreaking. And the volume has been mind-blowing to me.
Could we do the funny first? Give me an example.
Yes. I'll do the funny first. And in fact, I just got it in the green room while I was sitting out waiting for you. A young woman in Brooklyn is going to a Craigslist apartment interview yesterday and is handed a pledge by the leaseholder who is interviewing her for the spot and says, you may be considered for this spot only if you sign a pledge to vote for Barack Obama. And I mean, the woman needs to find somebody to pay half of her rent. And it seemed to me a shocking I've never in my life heard of anything like that.
Even if you are a supporter of the president. It just feels so totally coercive.
It feels terrible. I mean, there was a letter that I got a few weeks ago from a young guy whose parents said that they would keep helping her with her tuition only if she promised to and vote for Mitt Romney. And of course, as you pointed out just before we went live, I mean, I think all these people should sign away and then do what their heart tells them to do when they pull the
curtain
behind them.
It is a secret ballot.
Yeah.
But we've also been hearing from people who have received notices from their employers saying, if you vote for one of the candidates, you may not have a job.
Right. I mean, it's sometimes when I first heard that story, I thought, well, is this a case of a man or a woman in charge being clueless about his or her power, or is it old-fashioned bullying? And the more stories I heard, the more I've come down on the latter side, that it is really shameful the way people will try to leverage their power.
Well, you mentioned that the passions are particularly high during this election, and I've had experiences along those lines. A stranger on the subway turned to me this morning and made a comment about the political race. I had been reading something in the newspaper. He assumed that we were supporting the same candidate.
Well, there's a power. There is a powerful, I think, human instinct to try to find our bedfellows, and I can't imagine.
And politics makes strange bedfellows.
And was he right?
No,
he wasn't wrong, but he wasn't right either.
It was the comment. It didn't really matter what the politics was. The comment was something that I might have engaged in a conversation with him about, but I didn't want to do it.
Yeah, there's a high stakes sense of the take it or leave it game. People say their piece, and they sometimes can be very provocative because we're now, in the thanks to Bravo and MSNBC and Fox News, we're all fancying ourselves pundits these days and think we're going to make a shekel or two ourselves if we can be really provocative. So that sort of stuff might play on television terrifically, but it does not start a conversation.
So what's happened with you? Have you been to a family gathering or a dinner party or something else where everybody is on their best behavior, and then suddenly someone brings up politics?
What I've been the roughest dinner I've been to happened when somebody played an identity politics game and said, "If you love me, you could not vote for X." It was a gay guy, and I certainly can understand the logic, but I found it so manipulative. And I mean, talk about bringing a conversation to a stop, because people have all kinds of ways of prioritizing the world, and the idea that this guy should think that love for him would be on top of everyone's list of, you know, political issues. It was shocking, and it really stopped things.
Although that's not unusual, because we see people for whom this campaign really turns on same-sex marriage or abortion. Abortion after rape and incest or whatever, they have become major issues, even though supposedly it's all about the economy.
Now, I don't remember exactly what McCain's position was on same-sex marriage. I suspect it was not much different from Governor Romney's. But I don't remember people saying things like that. I don't remember anyone saying 4 years ago, "If you love me, you will do this or do that."
So, how do you avoid this? You said that conversation just put a halt to everything else. People just sat there in shock.
People sat there in shock, and somebody pointed out that I thought I could do it because I'm a gay person too. So I thought I could say, "Listen, I'm so with you," but I don't think that's a very successful way of convincing anybody of anything. And one of my tricks, and so far it has worked whenever I am in a rough situation, is by listening or doing my best imitation of putting on a listening face, even if what I'm hearing is really annoying the bejesus out of me. But people like to feel heard. And so if you listen, you say, "Well, that's a really interesting thing. Let me see if I understand what you're saying." And you can play it back, and then you can pivot like they do on the debates.
Can you just simply say, "Can we agree not to talk about politics?"
Oh, I absolutely think we can. Now, there are some places where provocateurs will take something like that and really run with it. But I think between people of goodwill, you can and as let's assume that the power dynamics are kind of equal. I think if your boss is sending you an email that says, "If you vote for someone so-and-so," or if you, you know, I got my the version that I most got on this question was from bosses who sent fundraising appeals to their employees. Mm. And that's even scarier because as you say, the voting box is secret, but they will know whether you gave to their...
And that is coercive.
Oh, I find that terribly coercive. And you might not be in a position to say to your boss, "Can we agree to disagree?"
We have a call from Diana in Boston. Hi, Diana. You're on the air.
So we have been trying to sort of do a little prevention here, and we have always raised our children to say that when you're speaking about somebody you disagree with, you must speak about it in such a way that that person would regard it as A, respectful, and B, fairly accurate. it's pretty tough these days. Do you have any suggestions further about how we could start at a wider level to teach young people civil disagreement, shall we say, when their relatives and everybody, almost everybody in the media, are giving them such bad counterexamples?
Gee, I grew up at a time when civil disobedience was what we were teaching our children.
Exactly.
We do that too.
Okay. Anyway,
It's a great question. It reminds me of one of the social cues that I got at my column, which was about an elementary school class who was staging this. I remember doing this in the 70s. They were staging a mock presidential campaign, and the thing devolved so quickly into a nasty sort of smearing popularity contest. And I sat back and thought, but these kids are 8. What else could it do? I mean, they're not going to be able to talk about tax credits. What else could this be but a nasty political popularity contest? So I think that you're doing a great job, and I think the schools can be someplace we turn to. But I think that there is – if you look at the – at the presidential debate numbers, for instance, there were between like 60 and 70 million people watching each of them. It has become a kind of Super Bowl, Academy Awards kind of popular entertainment. And the nastier they got, the more people tuned in, the more Twitter was rip-roaring on fire. I think we might be a step – I'm worried about you and your kid, but I don't know that I have any prescription for the culture.
But Diana, you're from Boston, and there are certain states that we know how the vote's going to go. Does it really matter whether anybody talks about the presidential race in Massachusetts or New York? California?
Well, I will say
or Mississippi.
Almost every one of our relatives is both of a different political persuasion and very aggressive in their disagreement. And Mr. Gaines, you had said there were certain things that
Galanis,
well.
There's the other writer called Stephen Gaines. There's a Stephen Gaines, but
sorry.
I'm Philip Galanis.
Excuse me.
No, please, don't be silly. That's the worst thing that should happen to me today.
If you are in a situation where there's grossly unequal power, as in it's somebody's older relative verbally attacking the opinion of a child, and the child knows that the facts are wrong, do you have any phrase that you can think of? I know you're good at thinking of phrases that sort of lubricate sticky situations.
Well, I mean, in a situation like that where you don't really, you want to be able to hug Grandpa on the way out the door, I think the agreement to you could very easily say the mother or the father could step in and say why don't we shift this conversation a little bit, this idea of, but you raise such an interesting thing, this idea about facts and the way people are now debating facts and finding facts that are just in polar opposition to each other. It's not profitable. It's certainly not profitable around a family dinner to have MSNBC take on Fox, across a big turkey. So I think I would try to make a getaway in that case as opposed to dig in further.
Luckily, Thanksgiving takes place after the election.
Yes.
A listener wonders whether the social media have made this whole situation worse.
Well, I don't know if you, listener, were having the same debate experiences that I did, but I had my Twitter feed and Facebook feed going during the debates, and I have to admit I found it tremendously entertaining. But you're right. It also made it, shockingly disrespectful. And there are mornings that I wake up and turn on my computer and I see a Facebook sort of a digitally altered picture of Governor Romney or the president, and it makes me really sad. So you're quite right. There, the flip side of the coin of entertainment is often people who go too far.
We also can assume, based on what I saw in the Twitter feeds, that some people will say my candidate won no matter what has gone on.
Oh, yeah.
And they have a way, not just the people who do the spin after the debates, but just, you know, if we're watching the debates with a strong sense of support of one of the candidates, every time that candidate makes what we think is a good point, we think it's a victory. And every time the other one makes one, we think that he's being a bully.
Well, that's exactly, yeah, absolutely.
And that worked both ways.
Oh, it absolutely works both ways.
We're going to take a little break, and we will come back with more of your calls, your comments, and the things that have been written into Philip Galanis of the New York Times. His Social Cues column appears every Sunday in the Styles section. He also is the author of the book called Social Cues. We are back with Philip Galanis of the New York Times and also of a book called Social Cues. Social Cues is going to be stuck on you for the rest of your life.
It's been very good to me, Leonard, as they used to say on Saturday Night Live about baseball. Social Cues been very, very good to me. It's a terrific job, if you like to yenta.
Well, you know, one of the reasons you're so successful is because people generally agree with your response. I'm sure that every once in a while you get someone writing to you saying, boy, were you wrong.
I wish I could say it was only every once in a while, but thank you.
Well, I usually agree with you. Anyway, let's see whether Alicia agrees with you. She is from North Vale, New Jersey. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. This is a very interesting conversation. I'd like some advice. There's a Sunday school that I've been attending for the past month or so, and even though the topic has nothing to do with politics, there are two women there, one of who has a very strong personality, who brings everything. Of course, we're studying the Bible, but literally everything she keeps bringing back to politics, and it's getting to the point where it's, you know, political rhetoric, it's kind of like there's this nasty undertone to it. And because I'm not a member of the church, I'm thinking about not even going back to the Sunday school class. And I know I don't want to say strongly how I feel because I don't want to turn anyone off because they don't know me. But is there any way to gracefully get through this or to kind of let them know maybe not everything has to do with politics that we're studying? Because it's starting to get to the point where it's not just someone voicing their opinion, but it's like strong and like hatred is coming from it.
Do you feel you're alone in objecting?
Oh, big time, because everyone else is quiet. Like every once in a while I try to, say something that kind of will maybe ease it a little bit, but everyone else is very quiet and she's very, very vocal and,
right,
you know, very strong in how she feels. And she's not amongst friends, you know, like she's making an assumption that everyone feels the same exact way, but I do not. And I'm just thinking about not going anymore because I don't know what to say. I mean, any advice I totally listen to.
Okay. What do you think, Philip?
It's hard to tell. Is this a group that's led by a minister or some kind of leader, or is it a self-directed?
It's a teacher led, but unfortunately, the teacher isn't quite bringing it back to where I think she should either.
Well, I think it would, rather than taking on the tiger, I would go and have a quiet word with the teacher afterwards and say, you know, I'm struggling. I'm here to talk about a certain set of issues, and I don't think I don't think we need to have the political commentary. Maybe you could have a word with a couple of the people in the group about that. And that would be a really good way of figuring out if you belong there.
But there also have been instances where members of the clergy have taken political positions and included them in their sermons. Is your only option to find a place where you're more likely to agree with the minister or the rabbi or the imam?
Well, there's probably in the right kind of religious community, there's probably a real place for discussion about whether you agree or disagree. But I think most of us could probably agree that politics from the pulpit is not it's not why we're there. And I think you are so entitled to go and have a word with the Sunday school teacher and see if you can make it, if you can neutralize it, or at least bring the volume down a little bit.
Although religion has become a major issue in this
huge
campaign, where people are citing their interpretation of the Bible as a way of defending their positions on various issues. You said that you brought in a whole bunch of other things that people have been writing to you.
This is maybe for our suburban listeners. Lawn signs have been huge. People stealing lawn signs. Mostly I get those letters come from the people whose lawn signs have been stolen, and they have a culprit in mind but no proof. And of course, in that case, better to say nothing than to falsely accuse your neighbor of stealing your lawn signs. But one case where someone admitted, copped to stealing a lawn sign and felt so terrible about it, didn't know whether it would be better to return it in the dark of night or to bring it back with her head hung and ring the doorbell. But my favorite one of all was that a neighbor had five identical lawn signs on a small little patch of front lawn. So the questioner wanted to know, isn't that like emails with all capitals? Isn't that like shouting? Do I have a right to ask her to turn the volume down a little bit on those lawn signs? And
what did you say?
To that woman, I said that if she thought she could go and have a civil conversation about it, to knock herself out. But the fact alone of the five lawn signs made me think that the person was perhaps seriously dug in, and it would be like going up to somebody who was coming to your door, knocking on your door, getting you to pledge to vote for Obama and saying, could I please try to convince you to vote for Romney instead? The decision has already been made. And we have the right to do what we like on our lawns, for better and worse.
My guest is Philip Galanis, who is the author of the New York Times Social Cues column for the Style section each Sunday, and also of the book called Social Cues. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. We've been getting a lot of people writing into our comment page. Maybe I'll just read a bunch of these,
sure,
and we can see which ones you want to address or find a way to mix them all together. Megan in Croton-on-Hudson says, I have a number of relatives who have very strong opposing views to mine. I found the best way to avoid a major fight is to say, if your candidate wins, I certainly hope you're right. Not in a snarky way, but in a genuinely positive way. I think that's...
I don't know how you could say those words in a non-snarky way, but if you can, I applaud it.
Deborah from New Jersey called in to say that there's been a dangerous generational shift from the past when Jimmy Stewart and Henry Fonda could share an apartment, even though they had different political leanings, and they did fine. But now the country has become so polarized that seems almost impossible.
Well, the good news about that is also the bad news. The bad news is that we're only polarized for the run-up to the election. And then after that, we really aren't doing a very good job of holding our candidates' feet to the fire. As a nation, we don't do a very good job holding anyone's feet to the fire, because I'm guessing that none of us would wish for the sort of impasse that we have in both houses of our Congress. So it's a strange thing. It's a hyper interest in a sport, like in an election, like a sporting event. But then once the result is out, we lose interest.
Well, we are the ones who have created the gridlock by voting for candidates who will then, for whatever reason or not, try to find some kind of a consensus.
Right.
What about, a listener asks, what about if the one who disagrees with what's being said, if you're the one who disagrees with what's being said, do you just let it go?
Well, I think sometimes you can just let it go because people are entitled to their opinions. But I think that if you're sitting down with a great friend and you think that you'd like to, or any kind of friend or someone you have a relationship with, and you'd like to make a point, I think you can. Listen, I've never had anyone get into a huge screaming match with me, because I think I'm really careful about not putting anybody in a position where I'm sort of saying that they're an idiot to think what they think, or that they're stupid, or that they're ill-informed, or...
Even if you think they are.
Even if I think they are, because, hello, we're all prejudiced in our hearts. And so just putting a kind of filter over things can be incredibly helpful.
Dave in Brooklyn writes, While I agree that attempting to manipulate someone's personal feelings toward another is rather distasteful, at the same time, the occurrence in this country of people voting against their own interests or those of their loved ones, often ignorantly, one would presume is rampant. Opening people's eyes to that is not an entirely bad thing.
I think that's a terrific point, because I think many, many people in this country do vote against their own interests. Why it should be, I couldn't begin to explain.
Don't you think it's often because we just grew up, my parents were supporters of one political party, and
sure.
I inherited that.
And if we listen to Fox, you hear one reductive story, and if you listen to MSNBC, you hear another reductive story, and it's the way we receive the world. But the thing that I think made it problematic in that case was to cast himself as the sort of Jesus Christ superstar role of the debate of the campaign, because that would, I think, tend to put people off. And I agreed with the guy who said that it would be a shame to vote for somebody who would strip away the rights of gay marriage and gay people generally.
A listener left this comment: we have lots of Republican and Democratic family members, and we never get into political discussions since, A, we realize we'll never change each other's minds, and, B, being a strong family is more important than the election of the day. Also, I can't choose my family, so I don't want to alienate them. When it comes to friends, however, it would be difficult for me to be good friends with people who don't more or less share my political persuasion. Right. These days, politics comes down to values more than policies, and I couldn't be friends with somebody who doesn't more or less share my values. When I hear something like that, it makes sense. Then I think of these mixed marriages. I don't know what else to call them.
Right.
Sometimes people agree politically when they get married. After a while, they drift apart, and they're trying to keep their marriage going despite
right.
the fact that they have very strong feelings in opposite directions.
And sometimes people who disagree with us have an incredible capacity for opening our eyes to an issue that's more complex than we might think it is. So it's a shame to think we'd weed out all the people who disagreed with us from our Facebook pages and from our lunch dates and from our from our coffee dates with people at the office. But I hear that point.
Well, did you ever wonder what a conversation between Mary Madeline and James Carville is like over the dinner table?
It's probably – well, they're both on television so much, they're probably never at the table at the same time.
And they don't have to ask each other because they already know. They watch that show.
Exactly.
Judy from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Well, I am from Brooklyn, but I'm originally from Arkansas, and I did learn something really good.
Oh, I thought you were from South Brooklyn.
South Brooklyn, exactly. I learned that you choose your battles. You never wrestle with a hog. And the reason is you don't get anywhere, and the hog loves it. So you size up the other person, and if it's necessary, you figure that's just wrestling with a hog, just keep your mouth shut.
There's nothing more to say to that, Judy. You're perfect.
But one of the big problems, and we've been circling around it, is that sometimes there's an unequal situation. And how do you deal with it when your boss expresses strong political opinions, some of which you may find offensive? Do you just simply decide not to wrestle with the hog?
Well, there are lots of bosses. I have a feeling if I worked for you, Leonard, and you were saying something that I disagreed with.
Impossible.
I could say it. I could say to you, boy, I didn't follow that, or I'm not sure. Or can we try that again? I don't agree with you, and it wouldn't be a big problem. But there are bosses, and people generally know when they're working for those bosses, who have a very my way or the highway kind of approach. So with those people, they're either, you know, your choices are probably limited to human resources or sucking it up or finding a new job. But it seems like taking on somebody in power when is Judy's exactly like Judy's wrestling with a hog.
Now, if somebody sends you an email message, somebody you know that is promoting something you don't agree with, do you simply delete? Do you simply say thanks for writing? Do you argue?
When I get many more at the Times than in my personal email, but I get lots of PR kinds of statements. And I think it's better just to I think it's better to let them pass. But your situation was when you know the person. And I think it's first, it's never a good idea to try to, I think, to do these things in writing, because emails always come off harsher than you ever meant them to. And the person who it was probably really wrong on her part or his part to send you the email in the first place, but you're saying, please don't send me these again, is going to sound like, please don't send me these again, when you meant, please don't send me these again.
And then they might very well write to your boss and say, Leonard Lopez is so snarky sometimes.
Yeah, I've got a funny flip side of the boss. A boss wrote to me and said, a social cue, and said, I've been so careful about not letting the people in my workplace know how I feel, but now you can go on to Google and say Leonard Lopate political contributions or Philip Galanis political contributions, and they will give you a history of every nickel you've given. And
luckily, I'm cheap.
And that, you know, he said then it came to be used against me by my employees. Uh-huh. And I think that's the kind of boss. That's the, you know, the flip side of a situation. I don't think we have to spend a lot of time feeling sorry for him, but that's the world we're living in now. Everything's a little more transparent than it used to be.
Well, there are people in our business who believe that we shouldn't be registered with one political party or the other, because people can find that out. And in theory, we try to be as objective as possible.
Right. I totally understand that. The Times has a list of things that I can do and not do that runs to the, you know, tens of pages.
You can't go to a political demonstration?
I can't. They'd rather. I mean, I'm not an employee. I'm a freelance writer. And so I can. But I still have lots and lots of restrictions, and I understand that. But the whole idea that people aren't going to have opinion, the idea of objectivity, has always seemed a little silly to me.
Just one more before you go.
Sure.
Do you have another one?
I loved this one.
Go ahead.
I have a boss who comes in every day and repeats what was on his favorite Fox show, and it takes about a full hour to get through takes a full hour to get through them. Is it possible to say anything to him about it? And I think we all know the answers to these things in our hearts, and the answers are always going to be different. It depends on it 100% depends on the boss. But this election is going to be over soon, and you are going to need a job on November 5th and 6th and 7th and 8th. So I think we should be careful when it comes to taking on the boss.
Philip Galanis writes the Social Cues column for the Sunday Times Style section. He's also the author of the book called Social Cues, and it's always so much fun talking with you.
Yes, terrific time. Thank you, Leonard. And everyone should vote, I hope.
But you should go out and vote for my candidate.